Again, this is the RPM PDP working group meeting. If you're part of the working group, please feel free to take a seat at the table. We do encourage working group members to sit at the table. And I think we look like we're just about ready to go. Hold on. So, again, this is the RPM PDP working group, and I would ask our tech folks to please go ahead and start the recording and let us know when it started with a... Okay. Looks like the recording has started. Excellent. Thank you very much. Hello and good afternoon and welcome, everyone. This is Julie Headland from ICANN.org, and welcome to the Rights Protection Mechanisms PDP working group today on the 10th of March at 15:15 local time. And I do welcome working group members to please come and join at the table if you can. We do still have some seats left. And again, this is a public session, so we certainly do encourage audience participation as well. And you'll note that there is a stand-up mic at the back of the room. We'll just ask everybody, when you are speaking, to please state your name for transcription purposes. So it's helpful if you also could state your affiliation as well. And with this, I would like to go ahead and turn things over to our co-chairs, Kathy Kleiman and Phil Corwin. Please, go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Kathy Kleiman, and I'm with co-chair Phil Corwin, and we welcome you to the first of the four sessions that we're having for the Rights Protection Mechanism PDP Working Group. These are face-to-face meetings that come on top of the hour-and-a-half meetings that we have every week, in addition to the sub-team meeting. So first, a huge thank you to the working group around this table, the working group participating remotely, and those who haven't joined us, aren't able to join us now, for just ongoing effort for a very, very long period of time. We appreciate your time, your energy, your involvement. We do need to share, as you've read, that co-chair Phil Corwin will no, co-chair J. Scott Evans will no longer be joining us. He has taken on new responsibilities at Adobe and sends his regrets and his regards, but he is no longer with us. So tomorrow we'll be talking about a new co-chair. But that's not our agenda for today. After a lot of consideration, we've divided the sessions into different distinct categories to help us stay focused. And this session, this hour-and-a-half session right now, we'll be talking about the results of the two sub-teams that are working on URS issues, one working on URS providers, questions we want to gather from the providers of URS services. That's 45 minutes. Then we'll move on to questions that arise from evaluation of the URS documents. These are two different sub-teams. Tomorrow we'll hear from the URS practitioners sub-team. So before we start, though, I'd like to ask if my co-chair, Phil Corwin, has some opening words to say. And again, thank you all for joining us. And we encourage people who are remote to participate just as actively as people who are here in person. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. And thank you all for being here today and not enjoying the tropical beauty outside. We acknowledge the contributions of J. Scott Evans. He made great contributions while he was one of the three co-chairs. And as Kathy mentioned, we'll be having a discussion at tomorrow's session about the process for moving forward as rapidly as possible to select a successor with the participation of the working group. So with that, we're going to first item of business is the providers subteam. And basically, we divided our URS work at this point into three subteams, one looking at practitioners, interfacing with people who have both brought complaints and defended against complaints with the URS, documents, it's reviewing all the relevant documents, and providers. And I've been working with the providers group. Show of hands, who else in the room has been part of that providers group? Okay, so we've got three others. Great. And what we have done in the providers group so far, we're not completed with our work, we're about halfway done. We reviewed all the rules for the URS, which are set forth in the applicant guidebook for the new TLD program. Then we reviewed the memorandum of understanding, which is a short two-page contractual agreement between ICANN and all the providers. The terms are the same for all the providers. And we did this to see what questions would arise, objective questions would arise about the role of the providers and how they handle their work. And we still have to go through the procedures which actually implement the rules. And then there's some technical specifications which we're going to review too. So we're about halfway through that work. We expect to be completed with one or two more meetings of that subteam after ICANN 61. And as you can see on the board, and it's very tiny print, so it's very hard to read unless you fill your screen. These are the initial questions we have derived from our review that I just described. And so you can see that we've now, these may not be the final questions. We haven't really reviewed them to see if there's any duplication or if it's necessary to go forward with anyone. This is kind of the raw work product from the sub-team's initial review of the procedures and the MOU. And you can see the rules and the MOU. So, Ariel, how do you suggest we go through here? Should we review what the proposed questions are, or what do you think the most efficient way? Let's see how many. We have seven pages here of questions. Well, I'll just run through them quickly. I'm not going to read the portion of the rules that the questions arose from, but just quickly through the questions. Maybe we'll stop at the end of each section. The first section is on communications. And so the questions we've come up with at this stage, and again, we may consolidate or refine a bit more. Had a provider send notification to the respondent? Have providers received responses from respondents after the deadline? That's the initial, I believe it's a 14-day deadline. Then is that deadline long enough? Of course, it's supposed to be an expedited proceeding. Do providers have any notification of delayed communications? That is, do they get notice that there's been some delay in the delivery of the email notice? Do they have any notification of non-delivery of communications? Going down in their supplemental rules, are there reasonable ways of communicating? And we haven't gotten to review of supplemental rules yet. That's down the road for our URS work. What percentage of communications were done in ways other than electronically via the internet? And a lot of these are just going to be posed to the providers to get their answers. And again, you can see they're fairly objective questions. They don't require a lot of subjective judgment to respond to them. Do providers conform with the communications timeline in accordance with this provision? And that's, you can see the reference there to the portion of the rules. And if respondents did not receive notifications the first time, how could they report on the bounce back? So just we want to make sure the respondents do get notice that a complaint's been brought against them. So let's stop there. That's on the rules relating to communications. Anybody want to discuss or raise questions about any of those proposed questions? I see John McElwain raising his hand.
So, John McElwain, for the record, if we can scroll up, there's just one question there that I thought was not particularly objective, and it was the one saying, like, is the deadline long enough? That is a subjective question and actually presupposes that maybe it's not long enough. I actually wasn't even really sure what people were, the drafters were getting at with that question.
Well, again, that's a good point, John. And again, this is a raw draft of questions we pulled out. We've been going very quickly through the rules on that sub-team. We covered all the rules in about just over 2 hours. So we may edit down these questions. And that's a good point that this is not that's more a policy question for the group rather than a question to be posed to the providers unless they think there's if they've gotten feedback on that, but we'll take that under consideration. Yes.
This is Arielle from staff. There's a remote question from George Kirkles. Perhaps an additional question might be, how will your notices be affected by GDPR if access to who is limited?
Thank you, Ariel. That's an interesting question, and about the topic that's going to be the predominant topic at this ICANN meeting. Can you?
This is Kathy Kleiman. There had been a discussion about whether we should actually talk about the GDPR and the URS here at this meeting. And we really hadn't, by the time that suggestion came up, we really didn't have the time to do the research. And it wasn't the work that was right in front of us. So we decided to go forward with the work right in front of us. But we should be putting together a list of questions regarding the GDPR, regarding how that disclosure of the registrant data is done. Also, what protection of the trademark owner is necessary. This is now a process we need to think about. So kind of let's queue it up, and we'll put it in probably towards the end, not of this meeting, but the end of this URS process, because we will need to think about it, and especially those people who are the data protection experts in the room. We would love your expertise on this. Thanks.
Okay. So let's go on to the next one, which is the questions regarding the complaint.
Actually, Kathy again. So George has said in the chat room, these are questions for the providers, so we need to get information from them if we're going to make any changes before May. I think that's a very good point. So, and in fact, preview of coming attractions on Thursday morning, right? Thursday morning? We will have the providers with us both in person and remotely. So we will be asking them, I believe, a subset of these questions, although Phil can clarify that, as well as other questions that we want to ask, including GDPR. So, George, I will queue that up for them, but also hopefully you'll be with us on Thursday morning as well. And let's start asking some of these questions. You're right, the providers should be thinking about this in light of some of their other activities.
Yeah, and we'll figure out how, of course, nobody knows the model yet, the interim or the final model for GDPR and how that would interact with the URS and the UDRP where we want the providers to get access. And I just lost connectivity, and now it's back. That's good that it's back. Let me scroll down again.
David, please.
Kathy, thanks. David McCauley, for the record. So I'm happy the providers will be here Thursday. Does that mean all three providers will be present?
I'm going to ask Ariel, who's been in contact with them.
And this is Ariel from staff. Two of the providers will participate remotely, and then one provider is forum that will attend in person.
Thank you.
And that's very exciting, and they've kind of turned their schedules upside down to respond to our request that they join us with kind of high-level information.
Okay, moving on to the complaint. Do providers accept complaints that don't contain all the required elements? Do they ask for any additional information beyond what's required in the rules? And moving down, excuse me one second. Okay. Has any provider used rules related to abusive complaints at all? There are rules regarding abusive complaints in the URS, and I don't know what's going on my screen. It keeps jumping around and changing size without my touching my laptop, which is odd. It makes it extremely difficult to read it. Maybe you could ask a question, Kathy, while I try to figure this out, because if you could see my screen, it's literally going in and out and jumping up and down. And
okay. So as Phil just read, has any provider used rules related to abusive complaint at all? And then I'm reading that again because the follow-up is, has any penalty been set forward? Next question, how have providers complied with their MOU paragraph 2B8 with regard to establishing and maintaining a process to monitor URS abuse? And I should just add, these are fairly new sections that were added with the URS. And so we're very interested. I mean, it makes sense. I'm not in the provider subteam, but it makes sense that they're asking questions about kind of how this these were fairly new when the GNSO adopted these rules. So I think it's interesting to ask questions about whether it's been used, these and how it's being used. But I can't tell you what MOU paragraph 2B8 says. Phil, should we keep going? Or do you want to comment on this?
No. My screen's behaving for the moment. There's stuff in the MOU about the providers establishing and maintaining a process for the monitoring of URS abuse and keeping a database on that. And we have questions about whether they're doing that and are they communicating with each other. And, of course, we don't know yet how many, if any, instances of complaint and abuse they've identified. Next questions. Yes?
Greg.
Thanks. Greg Chatton for the record. In that question, has any penalty been set forward? It seems, if you look at the rule, it just says that the complaints will not be accepted if the complainant has exceeded its quota. So that seems to be the penalty. So why are we asking if they've instituted on their own initiative an additional penalty not called for in the rules or procedures?
No, Greg, I think that's just an inartful way of asking whether any of them have actually barred a complainant because they've hit their quota of abusive complaints. Again, these are raw questions. We haven't refined them yet. So
maybe the problem is they're not in standard written English because, you know, it's just hard, obviously. I can't write in any other language other than English, so I admire people who can even get somewhere, you know. I don't know if that's inartful. We're going to need to make these questions into kind of, communicative English questions.
Yeah.
Apologies to whoever wrote it.
That is the plan. Again, and this is part of the plan to review them and see where they need to be clarified. They're not in final form yet to go to the providers.
And we'll just share that every sub-team, for people who are watching who haven't participated, every sub-team only had 2 weeks. So we're just getting started. But I have to share that in the practitioner sub-team, Greg rewrote the questions, so they are very articulate.
Complaint. Yeah, I'm going to, unless there's a burning for both remote questions in the room, I think it might be better if we just went through each section, like finish on the complaint and then review any questions or points to be made about that section that we've been reviewing rather than jumping in and out with questions. Is that okay with the folks in the room? Okay. So the next questions relate to provision of the rules would say that a complaint can't be filed against a domain name that's part of an open and active URS or UDRP. So the questions relating to that are, has a provider conducted a check on whether a domain case is already subject to an open and active URS or UDRP? If so, how do they find out? It's not clear how you'd know that. Do providers rely on the information provided by the complaint? Does anyone check for court cases in the event a respondent doesn't respond? And there's also provision there about open court cases. And how do providers view their responsibility under the 3G, that is their responsibility to make inquiry? How far do they have to go? So that's everything about the complaint. So any further questions or proposed clarifications for any of those questions? Yes.
This is Sarah Leon from staff. There's a remote comment from George Krikos about this section. An additional question might be, are providers coordinating abusive complaints across providers, since there would be abusive at multiple providers that cumulatively break the limit but not individually, since there's no central database of all URS decisions?
Okay. We'll note that for the record as we further refine these questions. And Ariel, I'm going to rely on you for any remote questions or comments because I'm in full screen mode and can't see any raised hands or chat, so I can read these questions. Next, short section, notice of complaint and locking of domain. The rules say that the complaint should be transmitted in English or translated by the provider into the predominant language used in the registrant's country or territory. And the question is, are providers checking who is information? Here's who is again, and GDPR relates to that. In order to determine the language to be used to transmit the notice of complaint, and then the other question is, are providers following this provision of the rules? That's a provision requiring that the electronic copy of the notice of complaint may be provided via email or an emailed link to an online platform. So those are the two questions on the notice of complaint and domain locking portion of the URS rules. Questions, comments? Okay, next section is on the response for when the respondent provides a response. First question is, have providers gotten responses alleging any abusive complaint, and how do they act if they've received those allegations from the respondent? There's a statement required to be in the response, and the question relating to it is the statement included in the provider's forms that it provided to the respondent? Okay. Next.
Before we get out of this section, I think, as I understand it, the allegation of an abusive complaint is made in the URS proceeding itself, and that the examiner makes the ruling as to whether it was abusive or not. And so this question seems to be kind of misaimed or needs to be recast to take into account the actual process.
Which question are you referring to?
The one have providers. The respondent may request a finding that the complaint was brought in abuse of the proceedings per URS procedure, paragraph, et cetera. And the question we intend to ask is, have providers gotten responses alleging any abusive complaint? And if so, how did providers act in these cases? The procedure is not that the provider receives
right.
it. It's in the response.
It's the examiner.
And the examiner gets it, not the provider, and then the examiner rules on it. We could ask how, how does the examiner, you know, inform the provider that he's ruled one way or the other on that? And I, from having reviewed a bunch of these decisions and, you know, working on our practitioners' questions, I can say that quite a lot of, when there have been responses, quite a lot of the respondents have alleged abusive complaints. We could also ask, you know, what the percentage, success percentage is on those complaints, because I saw a lot of allegations, and all, I don't believe I saw a single ruling that a complaint was, in fact, abusive. So it would be good to know, you know, how many they received and how many, you know, each were received by the examiners and how many made a ruling that, in fact, it was abusive.
Okay. Those are all good suggestions. I assume staff's taking notes as we get these suggestions.
I actually missed that.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Greg. You're correct. Of course, it'd be the examiner who would consider whether or not the complaint had been abusive, whether the allegation was correct or incorrect. The next questions relate to the provision of the rules which allow the respondent to, in exceptional cases, request an extension of the time period for filing the response. So the questions are, how often has the respondent asked for an extension, and how often has the complaint asked for an extension?
Is there any way in which a complainant asks for an extension?
Yeah, as I read that, that question probably needs to be struck. It doesn't make sense. And what do providers consider exceptional cases? Again, these are raw questions, and they need to be fleshed out a bit and clarified. Okay, and the next question relates to the rule that says no affirmative claims for relief by the respondent are permitted other than an allegation the complainant has filed an abusive complaint. And the question is, has the provider ever received affirmative claims for relief for reasons beyond? We wouldn't expect them to do anything about that because the rules are quite clear that
I mean, I assume, this is Greg again, I assume that if there was a complaint that had it would be thrown out because it's out of scope. But I guess raises a broader question for the providers, which is, do they review the complaints? Or how do they review the complaints, and what do they do to make sure that they're compliant? Because, you know, to answer this question yes or no, assuming somebody was kind of aggressive enough to put in an additional claim for relief or silly enough, that would only be found out if the examiner, if the providers, you know, reviewed the complaints, you know, substantively in some fashion. So I don't know if we've asked how they, what their intake process is.
You know, Greg, I think the way these questions are phrased, and this is the first time we're actually reviewing these questions in their raw form, because the two meetings we had before ICANN 61 were to go through the rules and the MOU. I think when we see provider, it's really the provider is a forum, is providing a forum in which they have panels, you know, they have examiners, and it's really the examiner. I think in a lot of these questions, provider presumes that the examiner is making the determination. So we can
we should confirm that. If they're literally just, you know, funneling, you know, filings to examiners, and the examiners have to, you know, see if they comply with the standards. It's a good question. I have no idea.
It says, Kathy, I believe there is some initial review of complaints to see if they meet kind of the threshold of having what they need. In this case, though, I think to follow along your line of reasoning, Greg, are the providers reviewing the responses, since we're on response? And that's an interesting question.
Right, that's a separate question. They may see the complaint. They may never see the responses.
Except to funnel them through, exactly. So maybe that's a follow-up. Are the providers seeing the responses?
Okay. Next section of the rules that says the provider's compliance check for response shall at least consist of, and then it's that it's the proper language, and payment of the fee. So the question is whether providers conduct any compliance check beyond those two items, since that's not exclusive. It says at least consist of. So we want to know if any of the providers are checking for anything else when they review the response. at the initial stage. If the response is determined to be noncompliant after the nonpayment, for reasons other than nonpayment, the examiner is permitted to make a reasonable inferences from the inadequacy of the response. So the questions relating to that, how many responses were determined to be noncompliant, how many were filed with but fees weren't paid, and can providers identify any cases in which they determined the responses was noncompliant for reasons other than the nonpayment of the fee. So that relates to that section, and that's all the questions regarding the response portion of the URS.
So, Greg Shanigan, we should also ask who determines whether a response is noncompliant, whether that's the provider or the examiner.
Sure, and you see in the reference to the rules, it says the examiner is permitted to make reasonable inferences from the inadequacy of the response. So,
right, I see they get to make the inference. That means in terms of, you know, once they have this inadequate response, they can make inferences from it. But the question is, who makes that determination in the first place? Is this sent down from the provider saying, here's an inadequate response, make your inferences? Or they just said, here's a response, you know, we haven't looked at it other than to send it off to you, and you can make a determination whether it's inadequate and then make any inferences you wish to make from that determination.
Okay. Other comments on the response portion of the rules? How are we doing on time here? Okay, what do we have, another 12 minutes? Okay, well.
Phil, if I might, this is Kathy.
Yes, Kathy.
Just noting that the response fee that we're talking about, since I happen to be carrying my secret URS rules, is for 15 or more. If the complainant files, complaints listing 15 or more disputed domain names registered by the same registrant will be subject to a response fee that will be refundable to the prevailing party. So I just wanted to let you know that this is one area that the URS is different from the UDRP.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out how to proceed here because we've got 12 minutes left for this section of this working group session, and we're on page 3 of 7 of these list of raw questions. So we're clearly not going to make it through all 7 pages in the 45 minutes we have. I guess we can just go as far as we can and pick up where we left off at the next meeting of the subteam, which anyone is welcome to join. I can't think of a better way to proceed unless someone else has a suggestion.
I have a suggestion. Can we ask who's doing the presentation for the documents section? Okay. Do you think that you'll be taking 45 minutes, or do you think it would be faster? Can we steal some of your time for providers? Okay. So 10 minutes? Thanks.
All right. So let's go about another 20 minutes to about 10 after the hour, and then we'll turn it over to John, too.
Thanks, John.
Okay. The next portion of the rules regards the examiner.
Sorry, we have a question.
It's on the next section. So sorry.
Okay. Okay. It's an offsides. That's a policy offsides. If you ask questions before we've reviewed the section, you're penalized 10 yards. This is about the examiner. Each provider is supposed to maintain and publish a publicly available list of examiners and their qualifications. And then the examiners are required to be impartial and independent and disclose to the provider any circumstances giving rise to justifiable doubt as to their impartiality or independence. And if at any stage during a proceeding new circumstances arise that could give rise to justifiable doubt about that, the examiner is supposed to promptly disclose it. This is basically about conflict of interest and impartiality. The questions are, the providers are generally doing a real good job of publishing their list of examiners and their qualifications, but we did notice some shortfalls, particularly of one of the providers. So question is, why were the qualifications of some examiners not published, particularly by the Asian Dispute Resolution Center. And then the questions, did the providers make the examiners aware of their need to be impartial and independent? Has there been any circumstances that gave rise to justifiable doubt regarding independence or impartiality of an examiner? And was this disclosed before or during the case proceeding? And what happened? Does the respondent have the ability to point out that the conflict of interest bias from the examiner, if the that'd be if the respondent had such knowledge clearly, can they do this in their response? That's not clear from the rules. Is there a situation that a respondent was aware of the conflict of interest? Is there a situation that the respondent, this is kind of duplicative of the previous question, we're going to have to consolidate these clearly. And is there any possibility for examiner shopping? I guess that's the, we want to know a little bit about the process for how the providers pick an examiner for a particular complaint. So these all need some refinement, but any questions about the questions or comments? You're now qualified.
Now I'm on side.
You're on side.
Michael Karaniklis for the record. So I'm looking at our email from February 21st after that day's call. And I see a few questions about examiners that I can't find in the list here, that I can't find in this document. And that specifically is how examiners are selected, what background they have, what training they have, and how they determine the standard of proof in URS cases. I can't find those in the list. Were they, I'd appreciate, am I looking at the wrong place, or would this be where they are, or are they not there?
I'm going to refer that question to staff, because staff is the group that put this initial list of questions together, and if there was any oversight, we have time to add questions.
This is Erin from staff. I will cross-check after this meeting and make sure all the questions are included in the consolidated document.
Thanks. Oh, just to note, it's in the document, if you're referring back to the email on the 21st, it's early on under notes as opposed to in the under six. Thanks.
Zach Muscovich, go ahead.
Thank you, Zach Muscovich. The second listed question, has there been any circumstances that give rise to justifiable doubt of the independence and impartiality of an examiner? Has there been any circumstances? I'd like to suggest rewording that to a related issue, and what are such circumstances that give rise to a justifiable doubt about impartiality? I think that question is somewhat discussed in the comments section in the column to the right of the question, but I think it's a fundamental question. What gives rise to questions about impartiality rather than have there been any such findings, which is a secondary question? Thank you.
This is Ariel from staff. There's a remote comment from George Kirkos. Do we know what the minimum qualifications are? If not, why not? For example, why publish the qualifications if we aren't able to judge whether minimum qualifications are surpassed?
Okay, we're noting all these suggestions and we'll review them as we further refine the list of questions. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
George Knight Chavansky for the record. On the point about respondents' ability to point out the conflict of interest, it should be extended to complainants as well. I don't know how a complainant under the URS points it out, but without, just calling up the provider and saying, we believe there's a conflict of interest for this examiner having been appointed, because these do come up. They've come up in the UDRP context.
Good point. Clearly, both parties should have an ability to say, hey, that's examiner shouldn't be here in this case. They have. There's some factor that would lead one to believe that they may not be impartial or may have a biased view or just have a previous relationship with one of the parties, whatever it is. Okay. Yes, Kathy.
Kathy, just asking a question as well. Do we even know whether the complainant and the respondents know who the examiner is before the decision is made? Given the speed that this is all taking place, is it only the provider that sits with that knowledge? I mean, we're thinking kind of traditional arbitrations where both sides would know ahead of time, but I'm not sure that's the case here. So that might be a question, is do complainants and respondents have an opportunity to know who the examiner is before the decision and object if there's a conflict of interest or issue arising under the existing rules? Offered as a suggestion.
Okay. I see Greg's hand up and then Susan Payne. So Greg first and then Susan.
Sure. It seems to me the questions don't align with the process that's described in the left-hand box. It says that the examiner will disclose to the provider, or, you know, if there is any circumstance giving rise to justifiable doubt, what happens is that the examiner discloses it to the provider. And if at any stage during the proceeding new circumstances arise, then the examiner will promptly disclose those circumstances. It makes it so if the question isn't really, have there been any circumstances that give rise to justifiable doubt? The question is, have there been any disclosures to the provider of circumstances, a disclosure by an examiner, and, you know, how those were dealt with, and whether there have been any subsequent disclosures of the type in the second sentence, you know, if something happens during a proceeding. It's the examiner doesn't, you know, I don't know if the second question doesn't really make sense either. If so, did the examiner disclose this before and or during the case proceeding? If not, what happened? I mean, if not, how would they know? Because it's only by a disclosure that we know about these things, unless there's a charge, and that's a whole different question about whether there's a route, and I guess there is a question about that, whether there's a route to challenge an examiner's independence regardless of whether they've made a disclosure or not.
Okay, thanks, Greg. Susan?
Yeah, thanks. Susan Payne for the record. I might have misheard you, Kathy, but I thought you were suggesting that that there could be a question about do the complainants and the respondents know who the examiner will be in advance of the case? Is that what you were asking?
There's a question here that says, does the respondent have the ability to point out the conflict of interest bias from the examiner, which would assume a prior question of does the respondent and the complainant presumably know who the examiner is before the decision is made?
Yeah, fine. That might well be a good question. I'm not sure that it's a reasonable question to ask in relation to the complainant because you don't have a case until the complainant has submitted their complaint. So, of course, they don't know who the examiner is. And I just wonder if we're getting too much in the weeds. And isn't really all we're really asking is to the providers, what process, if any, is there for a complainant and or a respondent to raise a concern about conflict of interest? And you know, do you have a process for that? That's really all we want to know, isn't it?
I will defer to acting co-chair and the noise in the background.
The co-chair is having technical difficulties. So I think what we're trying to get at here and, is that this is a very rapid process. Whoops. Oh, we still have some power. That's good. The complaint is filed. There's a very short time period for response. We may have, and we're not sure, we may have a situation where neither party knows who's been appointed as an examiner until the decision actually comes out. And if that's the case, and if one of them says, you know, hey, they found against me and I have good reason to believe that they should have disclosed some lack of impartiality but didn't, is there a way to raise that, whether it's the complainant or the respondent, that they may not know which examiner has been assigned to a case until the decision comes out because of the rapidity of the process?
And then Michael.
That sounds fine, but I mean, isn't what I just suggested as a question, isn't that still the question? I mean, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, we're still not saying what, if any, process is there for raising a concern about conflict of interest, full stop.
We will add that to the list. Get to you right away. I just want to repeat again what the process was that led to these questions in this form. The sub-team went very rapidly through the many, many pages of rules and then the short MOU and verbally said that suggests this question. We didn't spend a lot of time refining the question. We just said that suggests a question about this, question about that. Staff took notes. Staff compiled the questions based on what they thought they had heard during those discussions. The last call of that sub-team was a week and a half ago, and this document got to us in its current form, I believe, less than a week ago, sometime in the past week. So this is really the first time we're reviewing these. So these should not be regarded as being in final form, but being in very raw form. Go ahead.
Hi, Michael Karaniklis for the record. Yeah, I think that that question should be included because it does speak to the two other ones that you mentioned. We're asking, does the respondent have the ability to point to a conflict of interest? Are there situations where the respondents have pointed to a conflict of interest? In order to inform the results that we get back from those questions, we should also know the ability of respondents to know if there's a conflict of interest in advance, because if they're not figuring any of this, if they're not getting that information until after the thing is decided, then obviously they're not going to be in a position to be pointing out conflicts of interest. So a negative to those two would indicate something different.
Okay, thank you. The next section, communication between the parties and examiner. No questions arose, as you can see from the notes. The sub-team is going to revisit that after we look at supplemental rules. The next section is on general powers of the examiner. And
Phil, if I could interrupt just a second.
Yeah.
Sorry. Back on the previous question, I think we should also ask how the provider or how the examiner or discloses or affirms that they are independent and impartial.
Thanks, Greg. Back to general power of the examiner. There are some questions relating to the provision of the rules that says that if one or more domain names are registered with a privacy or proxy service or the nominal registrant changes after the complaint is filed, it's going to be the sole discretion of the examiner to determine if the respondents are sufficiently related and to dismiss the complaint with respect to any unrelated domain names. The examiner may rely on information submitted by the complainant and or the respondent in making its finding, and the questions, the raw questions arising for that are, does the provider know any situation that the nominal registrant changed post-filing of the complaint? If so, how did the provider handle it? And, of course, when we say provider, we're really referring to the examiner appointed by the provider. And how many complaints have been dismissed on the basis of the wrong respondent being named where the domain was registered with a privacy proxy service? So these are just trying to get any objective data. We don't know that this has ever arisen with a URS provider, but we're trying to find out if it has, and if so, how it was handled. I see Greg's hand up.
Does that last question make sense? If there is a privacy proxy service, I think you initiate the complaint against the privacy proxy service as the nominal registrant, and then they, I guess, you know, can reveal the actual registrant. But how could it be the wrong respondent? Am I missing something procedurally?
I don't think you are, and maybe this is a case where we might want to go back and clarify the rule itself.
George Nijewanski for the record. You can have situations where, let's say, your name was John Smith, right? And then you end up bringing an entire complaint against a John Smith, and you named the wrong John Smith. You just brought in the wrong person. And there have been examples of that, I think, on the UDRP side, where people, you know, tried to link up a bunch of domain names to somebody, and then they had a common name, and then there was an issue as to whether or not they had actually named the right party for these other domain names that they were there.
That I can understand. I actually just got a case dismissed because they sued the wrong party. My client was not the right party. But here this says where there's a privacy proxy service, so you don't know you know, who, whether there's a John Smith or not. I guess the only way this could possibly happen is if you were to sue, you know, link multiple domain names that were all under privacy proxy and then find out that you had different defendants. I'm not even sure that that's a problem, but that seems like an extremely
I agree with you. It seems like a much more remote thing, so maybe you have to refine it to see if there's ever been some sort of example of a situation where the wrong domain name owner got brought into a URS and shouldn't have been there. And the answer may be no, it hasn't occurred.
Okay, this is going to be the last section we review prior to turning things over to Mr. McElwain. It's on the language of proceedings. The complaint, of course, is supposed to be in English. The response can be in English or in one of the languages used for the notice of complaint, and we covered that earlier on. And the examiner is supposed to be fluent in English in the language of the response and will determine which language to issue, in which language to issue its determination in its sole discretion. And if there's no response, the language of determination shall be English. So with all of that, the questions we came up with are all the examiners indeed fluent in English? And I think we found for at least one of the providers that some of them did not appear to have English fluency, though they were fluent in the language of the region that the provider was based in. Are the assigned examiners fluent in the non-English language of the response? Just checking that the providers are picking the correct examiner when there's a possibility of a language other than English being used. And is there any challenge in the URS proceedings caused by linguistic deficiencies of the examiners? That question probably needs to be refined a bit. So comments or questions regarding language of the complaint and language of the decision? Go ahead.
Hi, Michael Karaniklis for the record. I think that last one is based on a comment that I might have made, which, if I'm remembering correctly, and I agree that it needs to be rephrased, I might suggest, is there any challenge, has there been any challenge posed by linguistic differences between the examiners and the participants in the process? Maybe participants isn't the right word, but the people, other people involved in the process. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for that. And we're going to wrap up now. I hope this section of this session has given you a feel for what we've been doing in our review in the provider sub-team of reviewing the key documents that govern the conduct of the providers and how they administer the URS. We're going to continue when that sub-team meets again, which will be the week after next, to continue to review the supplemental rules and then the technical. There's some technical specifications for the provider, see if there's any questions arising from that, and then do a very thorough review of the questions and make them more objective and clear before we're ready to get them to providers. We imagine we can get all that done in another two or three sessions and wrap up with that part and get questions out to the providers. And we'll take under consideration, given the rapidly moving implementation date or enforcement date for GDPR, whether there's any questions we need to get to the providers even sooner regarding anything related to their use of WHOIS data in the URS process. And with that, I'm going to step back and turn over the next portion of the program to John McElwain. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. John McElwain for the record. So while we get this pulled up, I basically just also want to take a moment to thank Jay Scott for his leadership on this sub-team. It was actually a really positive experience. Everybody was getting along, I thought, very well on the calls, and we made very good progress working through what we needed to work through in this subgroup. In addition, I thought while people are were going over this topic, there wasn't a lot of data for us in documents to look at. So if we've missed anything, please raise your hand. call it out. If you're in the chat room, please type it in. Because one of the things that we did is we really tried to rack our brains. Where can we find some data, some documents that help answer some of these questions? In addition, we also, when you got the materials for today's meeting, you probably saw that there we had actually three documents. I think we're probably just going to have time to go over this first one. Two of them are our suggestions of questions or areas for the practitioners group and the providers group to look at. So I think without any further ado, we can go ahead and start going over our document. And I'd like to scroll to when we start doing the red lines of the different topics. I don't think I have control to do that. Do I? Yeah. So can you scroll up a couple pages? Keep going. All right. So here we start coming into the data sources that we identified. Let me catch up with you. First being we looked at the suggested topic of what kind of data can we find to help answer some of the questions, the suggested questions in that third column. And the ideas that we have were three data sources we could come up with to look at issues with respect to the complaint. Let's see here. Use my PDF. Those documents were to ask providers about sort of a pass-fail on the administrative review of the complaint when it comes in or the response when it comes in, to talk to practitioners about their qualitative experiences with the complaint or with putting it together and their what they were seeing in terms of issues with grounds, filing, et cetera. And then there was some talk about looking at Rebecca's research concerning what types of marks are the subject of complaints. I'll pause there. Does anybody have any areas we think they would suggest to look at with respect to the complaint data and documents? Let me also, at this point, too, also the suggestions from our group, this is for staff, have those been sent off to the various sub-teams? No. Okay. So that's something in your next couple meetings. You can take a look at what we suggested, obviously take it or leave it, and but it were just areas that we wanted to pass along to those various sub-teams. Moving on to the notice, we had come up with two items to look at with respect to the notice. The first, and again, these are two areas that we referred it off to, the working groups from providers looking at information about what their process was on sending the notice and what procedures they have in place for non-deliverable notices. And from practitioners, again, asking their qualitative experiences about dealing with notice issues with respect to the complaint. Anybody have anything they would like to suggest, any other documents or data sources with respect to that topic? Go ahead.
This is Sarah Leon from staff. There's a remote comment from George Krikos. Are we looking at patterns of abusive spam and or phishing domains here from the large anti-abuse organizations, for example, block lists?
Not exactly sure how that's fitting in with these two topics. Maybe George can add it into the chat room. And our group is definitely glad to look at that and see where it can kind of fit into the data and the document section. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the response. Here we did have some data that we thought we could collect. So we thought that the document subteam, again, these are all sort of preliminary, we could look at some of the cases from a high level and look at where the response occurred to determine whether it was likely that, let's see, there were more than 15 or more domains contained. And then, excuse me, and then also look to see whether, sort of the rate of defaults. We also suggested to send it over to the providers to get their qualitative experience on any issues or communications about getting a domain name locked within 24 hours. And then it looks like there was a question for registries, their experiences about how after they've received notices from providers, did they have any issues? Did they contain the correct information? Things like that. Yeah.
Thank you, John. Barry Cobb for the record. Just to expand on the first and second bullets just a little bit, there is a bracket there about in regards to Rebecca Tushnet's research. So in that coding structure that staff had presented, I don't know, probably a month ago or so as a proposed way forward, when they're doing the actual coding, there's three different columns within that spreadsheet that of those complaints that did receive a response, when was it received, before 14 days, after 14 days, or within the six-month window, and if there was an extension. So that rolled up may provide some insight into this. And then secondarily, of the 250 cases where there was a response, then it's kind of being suggested here that there could be a deeper dive around what was contained in that response as well. Thank you.
Okay, with respect to the next section, so we're on the standards of proof section. We did identify that there were sources that could be looked at. Again, another referral to the practitioners concerning their qualitative experiences, but also to review some of the cases where the respondent prevailed, and in particular in relationship to the grounds or defenses mentioned in the sections 5.7, 5.8, which is the if it was a bad faith filing. So we did, in that sort of limited section, think that we would could get some use out of reviewing, again, a small subset of cases. Then there was also a suggestion that we brought up in that the standard of proof issue we think is primarily making sure that everybody understands it. So, again, it's a theme we've heard today before, but a suggestion of developing an examination guide for examiners to understand the distinction between such cases, almost like doing a WIPO overview for the URS cases. Oh, yeah, Kathy.
John, that's interesting because you're right. We're hearing a theme on that. Is that something that would be going to the providers to develop the examination guide the way WIPO develops it now, or just kind of wondering where that suggestion will be directed?
We didn't get into that level of detail as to where it would be directed, but if you take the WIPO model, that would be a good place for it to come out of, would be the providers, ensuring that there is more uniformity in their decisions. I think is always going to be beneficial to the URS as a whole.
This is Nat Cohen. Just to follow up on your comment, are you suggesting that the providers provide that guidance individually, or that it be an overall guidance for all providers?
Again, the group didn't really get into assigning that one to a particular subgroup to look at. I think that's really for this group as a whole to decide, is this a recommendation that we would include in the report, that there ought to be some sort of overview-like guidance? And I think it would be a nice thing to discuss with the providers. I think that's tomorrow's meeting. Okay, I'm going to move on then to defenses.
Sorry, John, this is Kathy. The providers will be on Thursday.
Sorry, yeah, don't want to confuse people. I just knew it was coming up. okay, so I see with defenses, there's a C notes under Section D. Barry, do you know what that's referencing?
So when the working group was reviewing these, they were kind of collapsed together in a single discussion. And so, probably the second sub-bullet about reviewing the 58 cases and the defenses is where that kind of is applicable, but they all kind of fit together, so just collapse together.
Okay, so I'm going to move on then to the remedies section. So here we're looking at some of the remedies, such as the perpetual block, et cetera, some ideas that came out of that. We referred some of the data collection or issues to the providers group, again, looking at qualitative experiences with respect to the scope and duration of the current remedies. We did find that a document source we thought would be useful here is taking a look at the IRT and STI reports to kind of get a feel for the origins of the remedies that were placed into the URS. Talked about needing to review the domain name lifecycle after suspension to better understand that and its impact by the URS process. And I can already hear George Kirikos typing into the chat room now, but also to look at the INTA study to see what sort of data can be gleaned from that might be useful to looking at some of the issues being raised in this remedy section. And so that was essentially what we had come up with on the looking at remedies and data sources for that. Anybody have anything that you think we missed with respect to that? Okay. I'm going to move on to the appeals section. In the appeals process, we had come up with two data sources there. We felt it would be reasonable to look at cases when there was a small enough subset of cases and where you could really take a look at them for an objective review. So the team was okay with reviewing the 14 cases in which there was an appeal to kind of look at what had gone on with those and to review any cases, and I'm not sure there are, where a de novo review had occurred. But those were the two areas we thought we would review, and Barry has a comment.
Thank you, John. This is Barry. So the second bullet, again, is kind of just keying off of Rebecca's research, as I mentioned, with the responses that they'll be tagging. Those responses where there wasn't a response within the first 14 days, but there was within that six-month window is, I understand, the de novo review, in fact. And so once those get tagged, then we'll be able to filter those out. It's hard to say how many of those, of the 250 are the de novo review, but probably, if I were to guess, maybe, probably no more than 50 or so, but just a guess for now.
Thanks. Moving on to the next topic, which was the potential overlap in process. So there's a potential overlap in process concerning the duration that respondent has to appeal. And again, we thought that looking at the appeals cases was really the only data source that you would have here. So that's why there's a reference up to, again, Rebecca's research and the cases we have talked about in the appeals process above. And again, that would also be looking at timing with respect to those cases primarily. moving on to the cost section. The purpose there was to look at cost allocation for the URS, so sort of the purpose of that section. And we identified three data sources here. Again, we referred some out to the practitioners and to the providers, and that was basically taking a look at getting a feel from practitioners, what is this cost, what are you charging, at least try to get some sort of anecdotal evidence on that. Providers would be looking at what fees do they charge. Again, the INTA study has a little bit of that information in there, and we could look at that data, so that was identified as well.
With my practitioner subteam hat on, I'm not the chair. I'm just a member. The question is asking practitioners how much they're charging to prepare a URS. Is that just one? It almost sounds like sensitive data in some ways, competitive data. Can you give some more rationale so that we can write it, as we're preparing those questions for the practitioners, kind of why we're asking those questions?
So The reason was to find out what they were charging. Perhaps we could anonymize that if they felt it was giving away any sort of trade secret. I think, I don't know if Laurie's here still, but I think the INTA study may have had some questions as to what people, what in-house counsel felt like their budget was, things to that effect. So it really is trying to get at what does the average URS cost a party. And I completely agree with your point, Kathy, is that we would need, if we're asking that question, we would need to do it in a manner that does not cause an issue concerning competitive issues. I can, for one thing, maybe I should have mentioned it here, although I don't think it's covered by the AIPLA survey. They're able to undertake a survey of average costs of litigation, including UDRP proceedings. So that people will respond to those types of surveys if done in the right way. Okay. Nobody else has anything on the costs? Continuing to move along. And the next section was on language. The issue there was, you know, what issues, any problems that were experienced with the use of an English-only requirement relating to the URS. And the URS document team came up with, again, pretty much looking references out, one, to the providers, requesting them to provide any information on their experiences, any feedback that they received regarding the language used in notices, response, and examinations, and whether there was the any experience they had with translations of the notices, and also to talk to practitioners to get their experience, whether they had noticed any issues with respect to the complaint being in only English. I think we did note that the form does provide reports to ICANN concerning the language, and we were wondering if the providers, the URS, were doing that as well. Making sure that all of the providers, if they were providing a report back to ICANN, that would be a source of data concerning the language of the proceedings. Anybody else have any other? Yeah. Go ahead first.
Max Malzoba, for the record. Have we identified the following thing as a question, as an issue? The first letter to registry, it comes in English. The second letter to registrar comes in English and in the language of documentation. Is it possible to send the same set of documents to both registry and registrar, given that the difference is just days?
That's a great point. I mean, I think we should note that as something to put into this document. Thank you.
Maxim, could you just repeat that so we capture it?
Maxim Ozobo, for the record. The first letter, under U.S. rules, registry has to follow certain steps written in three documents relevant to U.S. rules, technical, whatsoever, three of them on the U.S. page of ICANN. And the first letter with notification, which goes to registry, it's only the document in English. The second letter goes to registrar with copy to registry. And it has, in our case, it was Russian and English. And given the small period of time between those two, it would be nice to have the first letter containing two documents. So we basically found no reason for not having it.
Yeah, I'd also say that might be a good question to ask of the providers to see if there's a reason why they do it that way tomorrow, or excuse me, Thursday.
This is Sarah Leon from staff. There's a remote comment from George Kirkles. We should be able to get this data based on distribution of first country of respondent, second country of registrar for all complainants. And he continued, particularly data from default cases. If one assumes there's correlation between default and lack of understanding of the complaint due to language issues.
George.
George Nijovansky, for the record. On the language issue, I mean, one of the issues that comes up is that you have people who might be in a country, a particular country, but who are have complete fluency in the language. And so if you just do it based on, you know, you can gather that data on countries and all, but it's not going to really let you know whether your situations are dealing with people who are fluent or at least, you know, have websites that are in English or doing something in English on the complaint. So maybe a question to providers as part of this, as part of their experiences, is, you know, how many have instances that they had situations where it was demonstrated that a respondent had the capability of speaking English and understanding English.
Okay, I'm going to move on from the language if nobody else has any comments on it. So the next topic that we're looking at was abuse of process. And this was, again, the issue to examine there was what sanctions should be allowed for misuse of the URS by a trademark owner. And the team said that we didn't think there any data would be likely needed because there is an abuse case database. So we've already heard about that earlier on when we were going over the providers section. So we think that there is, according to the URS, again, a requirement that all abusive cases be documented, that there is a database set up. So we thought that would be sort of the answer to that data collection process. Any comments? All right. Education and training is the next topic. And again, the issue here was whether ICANN was properly doing its job in training registrants in rights and defenses of the URS and whether providers were training complainants and respondents. Our sub-team came up with two potential sources. The first was to review provider, registrar, and ICANN websites to see what information is currently being provided, what is out there. And then from providers to seek information about what type of training they are currently providing to their panelists. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and move on to the URS providers section. And that was to look at whether processes were being adopted by providers of URS services that were fair and reasonable. Our sub-team came up with two potential sources for data collection here. The first was to review provider, registrar, and ICANN websites again to see what type of information is provided today to folks, and then to seek feedback from the providers as to whether they evaluate their own processes and presumably whether ICANN does any or any sort of related third party does any processes to review those URS providers. Okay. Let's see. And then lastly, so it's going all the way down to the alternative processes. And when we hit this one, so this was to look at any possible alternatives to the URS, and we just said that we didn't think that there was really any data or documents to be reviewed here. It was more of a policy question. So again, the sub-team worked really well together. We went through all these in two meetings. We've got a nice list, I think, of documents and data we suggested that the other sub-teams take a look at, and I presume they'll do so over the next few meetings that they have. I would say, just as you know, personally, again, if anybody comes up with any data sources that they believe to be important or any documents that could be added to any of these topics, please feel free to, you know, send it out to the list. Let us know. As everybody knows, we've been really given charge to do as much data-driven analysis we can of this process. And so the more ideas that we have in places to search, the better. So we have a question, another one. Thanks.
This is Sarah Liang from staff. There's a remote question from George Kirkles. Should look at success metrics of alternate procedures, for example, look at academic research for the last question. Presumably, academics have studied various ADR mechanisms for different types of disputes.
So I probably need a little bit more detail on that, and maybe George can send that out. But it's certainly, again, that's exactly what we're looking for, is to get other suggestions as to data sources to look up for these questions. Susan?
Hi, Susan Payne. Thanks, John. I may have missed it, but when you were dealing with the section about abuse, sort of sanctions against abusive complainants, I think when we talked about that in the wider working group, we talked about the need for that sort of question area to be kind of mutual, so it should look at sort of respondent abuse as well as complainants, and it may be captured somewhere else and I missed it. But I thought, in relation to, this idea of is there a fair balance, and there's already a sanction against a complainant who is perceived to be acting in an abusive manner, but there isn't the same sort of sanction for the registrant if a registrant is viewed as being acting in an abusive manner. And so I thought maybe some kind of information gathering would be around, the sort of multiple the registrant who's been the respondent in multiple cases and lost every single one, and there may be no, there may not be any, but I think it would be a useful sort of information gathering purpose to see whether that situation arises, because, as I say, one of the things that I think we're supposed to be thinking about is whether there's the balance in terms of is there a balanced sanction against abusive behavior on both sides.
Yes, Susan, that's a great point. And Barry, is that the type of data we could probably look at, whether there's respondents with the same name in multiple different cases?
It is possible. Again, I'm probably going to lean on Rebecca's research. Again, they have columns in there for the complainant and the registrant / respondent. And I think in several of those cases, there's going to be privacy proxy listed there, so we won't know who was behind it, and likely they didn't respond for sure with those responses. The 250 cases, we'll know who they were. So it is possible, and we'll see how that gets rolled up, and we can probably run a pivot table against the registrant for that and see what it comes up with. But to answer Susan's Susan's question, I don't think that section had really brought on the balance that you had mentioned. And so I'm sure staff's documented in the notes, and we'll make sure to add that in.
Any other? Maxim?
Maxim Azoba, for the record. Actually, the idea behind that question, when we brought up it maybe a year or so ago, was that in situation where the same person registered like a lot of domains, obviously he doesn't have right for big companies, etc., well known, and he loses case after case, and there is nothing like, for example, more fast procedure for such persons. For example, if he lost or she lost 5 or 6 cases for a year cumulatively, there is no need to wait for all these 6 months, etc. But it was just an idea.
Something to put a pin in this, it may be interesting to ask practitioners and the providers, for that matter, whether they think that a sanction against respondents would make sense. Certainly, going through the lists that we were going through our spreadsheet, there were any number of cases against multiple domain names filed by the same applicant using the same string and multiple TLDs to which they, you know, clearly had no rights. As well, I believe there were certainly multiple cases brought by the same complainant. We'd have to see whether they brought multiple complaints against the same respondents at different times. But there are clearly cases where they found a bunch. You know, the biggest one was the Ashley case, where the guy registered at, you know, 300 Ashleys or whatever.
Anybody else have any data sources, documents they would like us to look at? All right, Kathy, can I turn it back over to you or Phil?
Absolutely. Thanks. So Kathy Kleiman, with a huge thank you for the document subteam and for John for taking over at the last minute to do the presentation. That sounded as if it wasn't taken over at the last minute. So thank you very much for the work, and to the provider subteam for the work that was presented here and the 2 weeks of evaluation and discussion and preparation, a lot of it in the last week as we were also preparing to come here. Practitioners, again, tomorrow. Something to think about, since we do have 3 whole minutes before we break and then come back for our next session, is one of the things that the leadership team has been discussing is who should do the data gathering. We can certainly take some comments now. This is intended more for something to think about. So right now we divide into subteams to figure out what the data questions might be. But the question is, who should do it? So I was just talking to Barry kind of privately when you were going through, and you said that ICANN collected, that when the documents team said that ICANN was collecting certain information, and Barry, of course, said he could gather it. But who should the data come back to, from the practitioner's question, from the documents questions, and from the provider questions? And so a question for the subteams, of course, is do you want to continue your work as evaluators? I'm not volunteering that because we haven't decided that, but this is going to be a question for one of our full working group meetings to consider. So if anyone has any comments, we do have a minute or two to discuss this very briefly. But it's a lot of data now that we'll be gathering. So any thoughts on who should do the data analysis and evaluation? Good. Well, I'll think about it. It is an overwhelming task. In that case, unless...
At my usual hourly rate, I'll do it.
We were expecting your pro bono. Why don't we start our break 1 minute early, and we resume at 5 p.m. for another 90-minute... Yes. Oh,
yeah, I just wanted to flag for people. I don't think I'm incorrect here, and staff can tell me if I am, but the next session is meant to be a sub-team meeting for the data sub. And so that's not to say that other people aren't very welcome if they want to observe, but we're not coming back for a kind of full working group meeting in this format. Our anticipation is that the data sub, who are a small group of people who've been working for months now, will gather in a you know, convenient huddle and continue our work in a you know, proper working session. And so if people want to observe that, that's wonderful. Or, you know, want to join us and sign up and become part of the data sub and do the work. But it's not a full working group meeting in this kind of presentational format.
And a quick note, this is Kathy. The data sub is a shorthand for a group that's been meeting for a very long time on the trademark clearinghouse data, since we've been talking about URS data all day. On the trademark clearinghouse data, we will be talking about protected marks lists. And it could be a very interesting conversation. So if you want to think back to when we were still doing the trademark clearinghouse work, this is part of that larger data gathering exercise, and you're certainly invited to join us. As Susan said, there's a core of people that have been meeting on this every Friday for months, but it's going to be an interesting discussion. We do have the questions we'll be sharing and that have come from the working group to the data subteam, the trademark clearinghouse data subteam. So feel free to join us in the next session that starts at 5:00.
Well, now that the purpose of the next 90 minutes has been clarified, that it's a sub-team meeting rather than a full working group meeting, but one that everyone is welcome to participate in or observe. We'll take our break, and we thank you all for your contributions during the past 90 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, and we can stop the recording.